right, we got it going on.
Blog Talk Radio.
Carol the Coach, Sex, Love, and Relationships. We talk about it here.
Carol the Coach. Compassion with contemporary relevance.
I am a psychotherapist. I can be your personal life coach and I can help you with your issues. There are no problems too small or too big. You can talk about anything.
Speaker, columnist, radio TV host, and commentator. Carol the Coach brings messages of wellness and empowerment within reach of everyday people every day.
Almost 5 years ago, I lost my soulmate in an accident. He was killed in a plane crash. Life just for me has seemed to stop.
There are groups all over the city. I mean, I teach one. It is a specific way to start thinking so that you shift how you see the world, which then shifts your energy, and then you feel better and you actually see things differently.
Carol the Coach. Always available to at carolthecoach.com.
Now, I've got Russell on the line.
I'm 47 years old. I'm a truck driver. I'm married. I have a wife in San Francisco.
Okay.
I haven't been home in 6 months. My thing is, I don't know if I have a sex addiction or what the problem is. Why do I want what I can't have? And as soon as I can have it, I don't want it anymore.
You're right on target when you say, I don't know if I have a sexual addiction. Well, guess what? Yes, you do. And you know what? That's my specialty, Russell, so you're at the right place. Continue.
I meet women online, and I'm in a different part of the country. I travel all 48 states, so I love sex.
I hear self-esteem issues. You never felt good enough, and you didn't feel like you were getting what you should have then, and you're reenacting that now. Do you want to change that about yourself? I got an interesting email.
From lots and lots of people, we get interesting emails all the time. Hey, I'm Carol Jurgensen Sheets, and boy, oh boy, I think these storms are affecting the radio station. Had a lot of difficulty getting on, so I feel much gratitude that I'm here with you tonight, and it's going to be an unusual show. I actually, as you well know, am a CSAT, and I'm part of ITAP, and ITAP is our International Trauma Institute for Addiction, and I heard wonderful things about this man, Ryan Salems. I'm not sure I'm saying his name right, but he actually did a keynote at one of our presentations. And so I Googled him and found out that Ryan was born in 1979, Kimberly Ann Solins. And he has spent his entire lifetime speaking on his transition that he made in 2005. He travels all over the United States to professionals and college audiences and youth, and talks about what it's like to be transgendered and how the healthcare system is helping that and dealing with it. And, you know, so I so badly wanted to talk with him because I have, as well as many other professionals have, three types of clients. You know, we have clients who have sexual addiction. And oftentimes, one of their preferences are transgendered prostitutes. And what I know to be true about that situation is that more than likely there's been some trauma reenactment. That person has had a lot of trauma in their life. Now, Ryan, as I asked him to send me his questions, it does not appear that he's had a bit of trauma, and obviously him making it his mission to educate the public about what it's like to come out and what it's like to be transgendered. I just thought it was nice if we put a face and a voice to a situation that probably a lot of us don't know much about. I also have transgendered clients that have sexual addiction. That is not Ryan's case. But I thought if we could get a better understanding of the struggles that he might have had, we'd all be a lot better off. Because there have always been challenging things about anybody who stands up for something that they really believe in that is not the norm. And Ryan admits to having had an eating disorder, which you know is oftentimes part of the issue that one can have if they're a sex addict. So I thought we'd talk with him tonight about how he has dealt with his shame and guilt, and how did he come out to his family, and, you know, how did he move past those struggles? I'm just a real believer in the more information we get about people in general, the more compassionate we can be, and the more we can put a face on things that we might not understand. And just in the same way as we ask our sex addicts, you know, when you're objectifying that person, you know, think of him or her as somebody's son or daughter, mother or father. I wanted to get to know Ryan, and I wanted to get to know more about what this transition has been like. So he has been patiently waiting, because clearly when I couldn't get on the air, neither could he. So Ryan, welcome to Sex Help with Carol the Coach. How are you this evening?
I'm good. Thank you for having me tonight.
Well, thanks for being patient. I do believe the storms affected Blog Talk, but luckily somebody heard my call and did call me back and figured out a way to reroute things. So I appreciate you being patient. Because we've had you on the books for quite a while, and you have made it your mission to educate people about your lifestyle, about the transgendered lifestyle, about eating disorders. So let's just get right down to it. You're a public speaker, and actually you came out, you made the transition in 2005. Where do you want to start as you talk about your story?
Well, I think it's helpful for people to hear about just kind of the beginning of life for anyone that is transgender. Just kind of understand a little bit about thoughts and feelings in childhood and as adolescence and then into your adult life.
Okay, so let's start by explaining to people, what does it mean to be transgendered?
Well, sometimes it may depend on who you ask. The term transgender is actually an umbrella term. So in the 1990s, activists adopted it as this umbrella term, and it represents people whose gender expression, when we talk about gender expression, we mean people, the way you communicate your gender, so the way you walk, the way you talk, your voice inflection, your body language, all the things that we use to communicate gender. So people whose gender expression is non-traditional for the sex that they are assigned at birth, as well as people like myself who have come out saying, hey, my gender identity, so my psychological sense of myself is different from the sex I assigned at birth. And so I'm choosing to align my external body with my internal sense of self.
Okay, so clearly, although you were born Kimberly Ann Salins, you, at what age, thought to yourself, I don't feel like I'm a girl. I feel like I'm male.
For me, it was around 2.5 to 3 years old. We, as humans, have a sense of our gender identity as early as 18 months, according to some researchers. Of course, that doesn't mean 18 months you're coming out and saying I'm transgender, because we don't have language at that point. But we have a sense as early as 18 months. And so for me, I had this very distinct memory around 2.5 to 3 that I just didn't feel the way that I was supposed to be presenting myself.
Okay, and how did you handle that? Did you convey that at all to either one of your parents?
Well, at that young of an age, I didn't necessarily convey it through language. What I did was we lived in the country. I grew up in Nebraska, and in our backyard we had a swimming pool, and everybody was out. My whole family was out, and we were all getting ready to go swimming, and I observed that my dad and my brother were in swimming trunks, my mom and my sister were in swimming suits, and I had a two-piece suit on, And so I decided to take the top part off so that I could have swimming trunks like my dad and my brother. So it was just that, that was the beginning for me of that sense that, hey, I want to be like the males. I don't identify as female.
Okay, and did they know this? I mean, do you think that they put that together, or did they think you were just kind of an expressive little girl who was carefree and didn't mind being topless?
I think that as I aged in my childhood, the idea of me being transgender never crossed anybody's mind. But then again, I was raised in the 80s, and although transgender identities have been with humans since the beginning of time and started to become more recognized in the United States in the 1940s and 50s. In the 80s, you didn't really have any language, TV shows, or anything really for the mass public to attach to. So I was just labeled as a tomboy.
Okay, so you were labeled a boy, and yet born and assigned female, and you were raised female. So, did you notice that people were treating you differently than being a female?
So are you asking that I noticed that people were treating me differently after I transitioned, or
no,
before?
Before. Like perhaps they thought, you know, she associates so much with being a boy. Maybe she's lesbian, or maybe she's confused, or maybe she's a tomboy.
Well, I definitely had the tomboy label going for me from the beginning. and I feel that some people definitely felt or stereotyped me as a lesbian because of the way that I presented myself. But again, in the community that I grew up in Nebraska, was a very rural community. So even in my adolescence, lesbian and gay issues were not talked about at all. We were very sheltered in that sense. And if it was talked about, it was in a very negative or stigmatized way. So we didn't, in the family, we didn't talk about that because my parents didn't even want to think that their child could be LGBT, or lesbian, gay, bisexual, or transgender.
Okay. So then clearly you had to have felt different, and it had to have been confusing. What do you think was the most challenging experience about growing up in the wrong body?
I think the most challenging experience for me was just not ever feeling like I fit in, and also not feeling like I could give my parents something that would make them feel really proud and full-heartedly accepting of me as their kid. When I say that, I don't want that to sound like my parents weren't proud of me or that they didn't love me, because that's not the case. It's just there are very subtle instances growing up with my family where I just got the message that how I felt or how I wanted to present was not okay with them, and they wished that I could be something different. And so feeling like you're not in a place where you belong or accepted or loved, that's a hard place to be at any age for any of us.
Well, 100%. And there accompanies that feeling is typically shame and guilt, like I'm not the person I'm supposed to be, but I am the person I am, so what's wrong with me? So is that the shame and guilt you carried on? And if so, at about what age do you think you first began to feel it?
I think shame and guilt, when it first started, was when I was 7 years old. And I had really long hair that went down my back. It was very long. And it was right before second grade, and my mom took me to town to get a haircut, just to get a trim up for the school year. And while I was there by myself with the woman doing my hair, I asked her to cut it short like a boy's. And I loved this haircut, but my parents did not. In fact, I remember running up to my dad afterwards at our house when I got home, and I could just see in his eyes that he did not like it and that he felt sadness from that. And it was the first time I got sent the message that it was not okay for me to present myself in a way that I felt comfortable. And so I started to have shame just around my presentation, my physical presentation as young as the age of 7. And then the guilt pursued on, especially as I moved into my adolescence. Because, you know, when you are ages 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, being a tomboy, especially in rural Nebraska, not a problem, right? You're just out there, you're playing, you're having a good time. But as your puberty begins to progress and you're moving into more of being a female instead of a girl, at least in my family, it was expected that you moved more into that female role. And so I felt guilt as I moved into my adolescence because my parents were expecting me to then move into a stage of life where I wanted to dress up, I wanted to wear wit makeup, I wanted to do my hair certain ways, I wanted to date boys, and I just wasn't there. That wasn't me. That didn't feel comfortable for me.
Yeah, that had to be very, very confusing. I mean, clearly you had to wonder, okay, now what is really going on?
Yes, and not knowing what that is.
Absolutely. Now, do you remember being exposed to anybody's story of being transgendered? I mean, at that point, there were a few Dateline stories and an Oprah story.
I don't remember being exposed. And you think that I would, because in 1993, a very prominent headline hit the nation when a transgender man by the name of Brandon Tina was murdered in Humboldt, Nebraska. His legal name was Tina Brandon. He grew up in Lincoln, Nebraska, and after high school moved down to Falls City to live as Brandon. And with his murder, there are a lot of stories cycling, but I'm sure I saw something covered around him at that time. I was 93, I would have been 14, but it hasn't stuck with me. Like, I can't think back to a moment and say, yes, I remember when this happened.
Right, right. Okay, so then you actually transitioned in 2005, is that correct?
Yes, it is.
And you were how old?
25 years old.
Okay. And so tell our listening audience what that means. I treat so many people who have transitioned, and what I know to be true is that they typically come in for counseling. I have to do an assessment on them. I have to decide, are they psychologically healthy enough to make the change, to have the hormones, to deal with the stress, the change in and of itself, the bias, the persecution that can occur. And I've never had a client that wasn't healthy enough to do that. I mean, people that come, by the time they come to my office, they want it, and they want it bad, and they're willing to do whatever it takes to be authentic and to be themselves. So what was your transition like?
Prior to my transition, six years prior to my transition, I was in treatment for an eating disorder, which happened when I was 19, going into my sophomore year of college. And I know that when that moment when I realized that I was transgender, I felt instant relief, but also a lot of fear and self-doubt and questioning. I wondered if this sense of being transgender was really a reality for me. It was a real feeling. It was something right for me. Or if it was really something related to my body image or my past history, the eating disorder. So I was very conflicted and scared. I was also conflicted and scared to come out to my therapist about my transgender identity because I feared that she also would not accept me or feel that this was a body image issue and transitioning just shouldn't be an option for me. Fortunately, when I came out to my therapist, she was very open and accepting of who I was and helped me begin my steps in my transition.
Okay, so tell our listening audience, what were some of your steps?
Well, so, I mean, everybody's story is different, and what everybody needs is different. So whenever I tell my story, I always say I'm not a spokesperson for a trans community, nor what I need, what other people are seeking. But for me, when I looked at my physical transition, in December of 2004, I found a book on transgender men, and that's when I knew I was transgender. In February, I came out to my therapist. And in May of 2005, I began my physical transition. And so for me, that began with a chest surgery or the removal of the breast. So I would have a male chest. And then in June of that year, I began on a hormone therapy for transgender men. That's testosterone. And I do injectables. So every 10 days, I inject testosterone into my body. And then 3 months after that, I had my name legally changed so that I could change my name and all of my documentation. A year later, in 2006, I had a complete hysterectomy. And then in 2008, I flew to Belgrade, Serbia, where I had a lower surgery completed.
Okay, so what was that like, and how did you make those arrangements? I mean, that was so far away.
So, any part of a physical transition is very stressful, just because, one, you have to look at finances, and we live in a society where we pay for health insurance, and different health insurance companies have different forms of coverage. And so when we look at transition-related care, it may not be included for insurance coverage. And for me, that was the case. The only thing I was able to get covered in my transition was my hysterectomy, which I had to use a lawyer to get approved. So it was a very long process in that sense. So just financially, it was very scary. When you look at the lower surgery, going overseas, of course, is scary because it's something you're not familiar with. And going to Belgrade, Serbia, it's not like a place where we talk about like London or Paris or something like that. You know, Belgrade, Serbia is not a destination that most people probably choose. So there's also a lot of unknowns around that. But things were wonderful there. And I felt reassured before going, just knowing that other guys had went there from the United States. And a lot more guys are going now. They're known for taking care of their clients, for having good outcomes. Of course, you always have risks and complications with surgeries, but overall having good outcomes and following up with you, treating you like family.
And so I know surgery can be anywhere from about $17,000 to $40,000. What do you know the range to be, you know, depending on whether you go to Thailand or Canada or, well, there's just a variety of places.
Well, it depends on what surgery you're talking about. If you're talking about lower surgery, it again depends on who is having the surgery completed and where they're going. So lower surgeries that we see for transgender women may cost less than the lower surgery that we see for transgender men, again, depending on the surgeon they go to and what procedure they're looking to have, because you have some different options and choices. But going high route with transgender men, like if they chose to have something called a phalloplasty, which is a construction of a full-size penis, that could run upwards of $300,000 by the end of having all the procedures completed. One of my good friends had a phalloplasty completed in the UK where it was covered by by the healthcare system in the UK, but that if he would have had to pay out of pocket, it would have been the equivalent of $100,000.
Okay, that's interesting. That's quite the range. And you're right. I wasn't just thinking about transitioning from female to male. I was also thinking about transitioning from male to female, and that tends to be cheaper.
lower surgery tends to be less expensive if you're looking at a vaginoplasty and labiaplasty procedure, which is the construction of the vaginal canal and the labia, versus a phalloplasty, which is the construction of a full-size penis. For transgender men, there's also the option of doing something called a metoidioplasty, which is actually a procedure that I chose to have completed in Belgrade, where they use the clitoral tissue to create a penis, because clitoral tissue and penile tissue, it's the same stuff. It's erectile tissue.
Okay. So now, you had to have felt excited and afraid all at the same time.
Yes.
No? Yes?
Yes,
okay.
Definitely yes.
Well, I bet. And so, you know, obviously you had to be fairly healthy, and yet you had your own struggles. And one of those struggles, at least in your memoir, Second Son, that you write about your eating disorder. So tell us a little bit about your eating disorder, especially what you believed caused it, and are you recovering from that today?
Well, beginning with the last part of your question, I used to say that I was recovered from my eating disorder, but over time and the more work I do in the field and the more collaborations I have, I say that I'm in recovery. Just because eating disorder is categorized as a mental illness. We don't have cures for mental illnesses. And I recognize now that the word eating disorder is very misleading about the actual disorder, because it's food that's really not the issue. That's just the tool that we use to cope with the anxiety we're feeling, the shame we're feeling, the fear we're feeling, any of our emotions, that's what we're using to cope. So now I've learned how to be aware of my emotions, and when the negative body image issues come into play, or I start thinking about maybe how I should change some sort of behavior, I then stop myself and say, hey, what's going on? What am I really feeling right now? And I'm finding that when these thoughts or behaviors really start to transpire inside myself, it's around either feeling insecure about finances, insecure about being relevant anymore in the work that I do, or having interactions with my parents and not, again, feeling that I am meeting what it is that they wanted from their child. So I'm still working through that, and I am behavior-free, but it's definitely a process. It takes time. As far as cause, there's no one root cause. There's contributing factors to it, and I just had many things that kind of blended together that made me one of those individuals that struggles with it. My transgender identity was definitely part of that, and not understanding my transgender identity was definitely part of that at the time. It wasn't all of it, though.
Okay, so tell me, what kind of treatment did you get for the eating disorder?
I probably would have been a candidate for inpatient treatment, but fortunately I was able to avoid that. And so I participated in inpatient out-of-office therapy. Not inpatient therapy. So I participated in therapy, and then I worked with a nutritionist, and I was part of a support group. And then I also was part of a eating disorder education prevention student organization on my campus. And I was part of all of these different programs for 6 years. Meeting my therapist sometimes 2 times a week, meeting with my nutritionist weekly, having my support groups, doing research, writing different articles on it. So I was really very invested in not only learning more about it, but also trying to work on my own emotions and feelings around the things that were causing me to go down these roads of using food or exercise in an unhealthy manner.
Well, it's amazing that you've done all this emotional work on yourself as well as the physical work. So oftentimes when people are really working on themselves, they find that it's easier to do that without a relationship. how many romantic relationships have you had? And if you have had romantic relationships, how have they been impacted?
When I was in the throes of my eating disorder, I did not have any romantic relationships. My eating disorder began right before I started my sophomore year of college, which was right after a breakup as well with a man that I was dating at the time. And I did not date anyone for the next 6 years. I was too absorbed in the eating disorder and focused on that, as well as my schoolwork, because I maintained straight A's throughout this time, that relationships just wouldn't have been a possibility. I could not even take care of myself, let alone be able to take care of a relationship at that time.
Okay. And so the first relationship that you had after getting healthier was when?
So that happened after those 6 years, and it began by first coming out as a lesbian, which was very difficult for me to do. One, again, because of the shame around that, with the feeling that I wouldn't be accepted by my family or my community that I grew up in as a kid. And two, because looking back now, the word lesbian, if we look at the definition of it, would be a woman that could be in a romantic relationship with another woman. And for me, that just having two women together, it didn't feel right because I didn't identify as a woman. But the amazing thing that happened was when I started to look at sexuality in my eating disorder treatment, and when I came out as lesbian, and when I started dating a woman about a month after coming out, my behaviors around food ended. My unhealthy behaviors around food ended at that moment. So it's pretty amazing. That's when it starts to be the message that, hey, when you honor an aspect of who you are, instead of being fearful of it and trying to run away from it, you're going to start having some healing on the inside. The only problem was is that my negative body image issues were still there. Suicidal ideation was still there 24/7. And my feelings of my body in this romantic relationship were still in a place where it didn't feel right.
Okay, now explain that to us a little bit better. That's
okay.
A little confusing.
While I was in my relationship with my partner, who was a woman, what felt right was the emotional and physical attraction to her and having that be my primary relationship. What felt wrong was, for instance, when we were intimate, her interacting with my body. My body didn't feel right. It didn't feel like it should be interacted with. I felt a lot of shame and guilt around breast or anything else that would be sexual on a female body. It just didn't feel like me. And I didn't understand that for the first 8 months in that relationship. Again, related it back to body image issues. But now, since I've started my transition, and now I'm 10 years into it, I just realized it's because my body was meant to be male, and I wanted to have a chest, you know, with pectoral muscles and not breast on it. I wanted to have genitals that wasn't in the form of a vulva. And so I just had a lot of shame around that before.
Okay. Well, I get that, boy, not only were you being more authentic, but you were really, for the first time ever, in your own skin, the skin that you wanted to be born into and could not seem to make that happen until age 25.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. All right. So then here you go. So today you said when it comes to the eating disorder, you used to say that you were recovered. But now how do you reference that?
That I'm in recovery.
You're in recovery. Got it. Because you recognize that if something became incongruent with you, it might rear its ugly head.
It could, if I'm not staying aware and conscious of my emotions.
Uh-huh. And you're still working with the same therapist that you did when you came out?
You know, I wish that I could have continued with her, even just for maintenance, you know, here and there, going and doing a check-in. I wish that I could have continued with her, but unfortunately, she was a therapist on my university campus. And so when I graduated from my second master's program, I wasn't allowed to see her anymore because I was no longer a student.
Oh, I know. Those transitions are very difficult, too, when your insurance changes or that your therapist moves away. And in this situation, you no longer were part of the population that she served.
Yes, yes. And it's something that it's very sad for me because 6 years with her, bless her for the patience that she had with me. You know, we really built a very strong relationship.
Well, and I don't know if this is a stereotype, so Ryan, feel free to call me out on this. But my experience is when a transgendered person, and do you find that being called a tranny feels derogatory or feels like an affectionate nickname?
Absolutely. I can't speak for everyone, but I think I could probably speak for 95 or 98 or 99 or 99.5% of the population that the word tranny is not affectionate. It's a very derogatory and stigmatized term.
All right. So that is something that you would never personally want to be called.
Absolutely not. Yeah.
Okay. And explain why, because so many of the transgender clients that I work with, that's how they self-refer. And so that's good to know that in many of the cases of people that you know, that feels derogatory. So we all, whether we're clients or professionals, should really not use that word.
Well, if you're in with a session, like when I do trainings for professionals, I always say in that session, mirror the language that your client is using. So if you have clients using that, I do think it'd be interesting to explore why they use it, to have a sense, are they using it in a way because they feel more aggressive or because they feel shame around their identity, or are they using it in a way because they see it as being a celebration and a way of empowering themselves. Because language is a thing where it's constantly changing and it takes on new meanings with different people, just like the term queer. Some people are going to hear the term queer and they're going to cringe at that and say it's completely derogatory, never use it. While when we look at the LGBT community, there's a lot of people, especially in generations that I would say are 40 or below, who use it as an empowering term and take pride in it. So when we hear the term tranny, it may be that maybe more people in later generations view it differently than the younger generation today. But with the younger generations today, we see that term as being derogatory in a sense that it's referring, it's dehumanizing of the transgender person.
All right. Well, good to know. So now I've got to think of what the question was that I was going to ask. Oh, I know. So what I was going to say is that many of the transgendered clients that I work with are very, very loyal. When they are, have shared their story and all the baggage that may come with that, and they feel comfortable, it's almost like they've created a family of choice in a therapy session. You know, I always giggle and say, well, therapists are, male or female are usually the mother. But truly, my experience is that transgender population are incredibly loyal clients. You know, if they like you, they're with you through thick and thin. Do you find that to be true, too?
I can definitely see how that can happen, just because so many people who are transgender have experienced rejection in their life, whether it be rejection from their parents, rejection from their siblings, rejection from their children, rejection from current partners or past partners. So to be able to be sitting in a room and, one, talking about what you're feeling and not feeling shamed for that, and, two, getting these positive interactions with someone, that can be rare. And so giving that up would be like losing, in a way, a family member in your life, someone that truly can appreciate you and be there and listen and support you.
All right. So then you mentioned feeling shame and guilt, you know, in terms of your own family and really not, you know, seeing that look on your father's face and feeling like you had disappointed him. How are they doing with your transgendered status? And, you know, how are they doing with Ryan as opposed to Kimberly?
It's always a hard question to answer because I don't live in their shoes. I can't feel that half as far as perceptions or assumptions from our interactions. I think deep down inside, at least I hope deep down inside, they're happy to see that their kid is doing okay. You know, I still have moments of struggle and, you know, different challenges in life, but I'm doing okay. I hope that they're happy to see that I am actually feeling like my authentic self and in a comfortable place as far as my physical being. This is who I am. Why I'm transgender, I don't know. No, researchers can't even tell us why. They have theories, but we don't have a pinpoint, right? But it's a part of who I am. And so I hope that they can recognize, and like I said in the letter when I came out to them, they could either have a happy kid, which, you know, happy, it's not like you're happy all the time, but more happy kid, or a dead kid, because I had already attempted suicide twice to my transition. I just have to be who I am and not fear people's judgment, people's ignorance around this topic. And hope that over time, which is one of the reasons I share my story, that more people just open their minds and hearts to the diversity that we are as humans.
Well, 100%. And I'm seeing that more and more and more. I mean, it's kind of like, I know that you spoke for ITAP, and ITAP is obviously that International Trauma and Addiction Professional Association. And just as with sex addiction, people will go, there's no such thing as sexual addiction. And yet, my clients, my listeners, know that, yes, there is. And so I'm always saying, hey, we're all pioneers in this field right now. And in so many ways, so are you. You're a pioneer.
I am very happy for the people that were in the past before me to help me start my path. But, you know, I've been around for a while now, and I've done various projects that I do hope has, and the way I've been told from other people, it has. It's helped them come to terms of who they are and really honor that. And that's really the most important thing in our lives. Is this is the only life we have to live, so we need to be able to honor it as fully as we can.
Well, 100%. So now, how are you doing with your life? Now, it's almost been a decade since your transition. And I was just thinking about how cool it was that you're in Wikipedia. I mean, how cool is that, that you're a representative of this kind of psychoeducational information?
Oh, Wikipedia. I don't even know how that happened, but whoever created that, thank you. So,
I mean, you're four pages long in it.
Right. Wow. There you go.
Yeah, because you've written books, and can you share a little bit about the books that you've written and how people can get a hold of those books? Like,
yeah.
Second Son,
well,
Transitioning Toward My Destiny, Life, and Love.
Yeah. Currently, Second Son's my only book. I am working on my second memoir, which will be picking up where Second Son left off. But I just need a little bit more time with it. I need a little bit more time, a little bit more reflection, because I really want to be able to, my second book, I want to be able to talk about life post-transition, because there are a lot of books out there about the transition, but what's life like once you kind of settled into who you are, right? But with Second Son, it really explores everything before that. So it explores my childhood and the different thoughts and feelings I had, my adolescence and dating, my adult life and how the eating disorder impacted me and how I worked through that. my lesbian relationship, coming out as a trans man while in a lesbian relationship, and then moving on to where I am today. It's been received really well. It receives good reviews, and so I'm just really happy to have it out there as a resource for people. I write in a way that's very reachable, very easy, so it flows mm-hmm. quick.
Yeah, it's very narrative, people, isn't it? I mean, it's just like you're
yes.
talking to people.
Yes, yes, which is, you know, I decided to write this book for a couple of reasons. The first reason was I've been doing public speaking on my story for several years around the nation. The second reason was I had a master's in English and creative writing, so I figured I might as well put it to use. And so I did. I wanted to just be able to have people just ride along with me and kind of feel like they're just right there hanging out with me as I tell the story.
Okay, now, interesting that I thought there was a second book. I don't know if I read that in your bio or saw it on Wikipedia that you're working on it, but, you know, you have spent so much of the last decade presenting information, and I've said twice that you've made it your mission to illuminate people and to share what you've been through and to educate people. So you provide these professional training sessions for mental health and medical providers. What do you think can make them better providers? Because some of our listeners are clinicians who work in the mental health field.
Well, the first thing is to recognize that one transgender identity does not define them. I've ran into many instances where providers or clinicians think that there's a checkbox for trans identities and that everybody's going to be wanting or desiring the same things. That's just not the case. We are all diverse and we all have different needs. The second thing that's important is being able to be flexible. Being able to be on this ride with your client or patient and to allow them the space to test the waters and see what is comfortable for them. You know, especially when we're looking at providers that are working with the youth today, there needs to be room for exploration and seeing what fits. The third thing for providers and clinicians is just staying abreast of new information and the new standards of care that are being released, and understand that things are rapidly changing, especially in transgender medicine. You know, I write online healthcare modules for clinicians through an organization, and our work groups, we've been going for 7 years now on this project, and things that we've written last year, some of the items are already out of date that we need to already update. So you really have to be in tune, part of associations, and able to stay up to date on these issues.
Well, that makes so much sense. And again, this is such a new situation. I mean, as you've done your history, to the best of your knowledge, when did the first person receive their surgery? How early was that?
In the United States, the earliest would date back to the, it was either 1902 or 1903, when they did the first orchiectomy, so the removal of the testicles. Then in 1917, a trans man named Alan Hart, they did the first complete hysterectomy. And then moving into 1930s and 40s, we started to see more procedures being done more commonly on transgender women than transgender men. In the 1950s, when Christine Jorgensen came out, that's when we really started to see the medical community here in the United States more interested in these procedures, and we started to see more gender clinics pop up. But the interesting thing about these gender clinics that popped up during the 50s, 60s, and 70s is that they were very black and white in the sense or Ozzy and Harriet, I like to kind of say in a sense, or Leave It to Beaver, where they wanted people that transitioned to fulfill that stereotypical role of either what a man or a woman should be at that time. They are very homophobic, so for transgender women, one of the requirements is that they did indeed be in a relationship with a man after their transition, so they were in a heterosexual relationship, and that they not talk about their transition. So the history is very interesting here in the United States. A great book is called Transgender History, Transgender History by Susan Stryker. Just really great book and information around trans identities here in the United States.
Got it. Well, as we end for tonight, can you think of any other advice that you would like to share with our listening audience? Because you've done a fabulous job of giving them some information about what it was like for you. And I think anybody who hears you can tell that, you know, you really are content with being who you are, and, you know, you've got this purpose, and you're just making a big difference in the lives of others.
You know, the thing that I continue to spread, whether it's with a high school audience, a college audience, or an adult audience, is that it's just so important for us to be able to push past our fears, no matter how scary it is, and to push past the what ifs and allow ourselves to be in those unknown spaces. This is the life that we have to live. Everybody has different theories of what happens to us after we die. So we need to live it as authentically as possible and really honor what our internal identity is telling us.
Okay. Got it. Well, thank you so much for sharing your story, and I look forward to the great things that you're going to do, and I just really appreciate you being there for my listening audience and for anybody else who wants to know more about this. I'm, you know, going to be able to refer them to this show. So thanks so much, Ryan.
Thank you, Carol. I really appreciate you having me on.
Absolutely. And if people want to get a hold of you because they want to ask you additional questions, how can they do that?
The best way would be to visit my website, which is ryanthallans.com, S-A-L-L-A-N-S, is the spelling of my last name. Through there, they can find different information and resources, as well as my email.
All right. Well, thanks, Ryan, and look forward to talking again.
All right, sounds good. You have a good night.
Okay. So, as you can see, so oftentimes, people are born in a situation where there is some cross to bear until they turn their life around. For Ryan, his cross to bear was being born a woman, being born a female, and then making the choice to be more authentic and change and go through the surgery and educate others. This is the same thing that I tell you, sex addicts and partners of sex addicts, that this is your cross to bear, and it's not anything to feel dark about. It's where you get to ask yourself, what do I need to do to make my life different? How can I use this cross to benefit others and myself? So that's what I'll leave you with tonight. I'm going to ask you, you know, how has your sexual addiction, or how has living with a partner, as a partner of a sex addict, how has that made you a stronger person, and how can you take that forward and truly be authentic, be genuine, and contribute in great ways to society? Get back with me and let me know. Send me an email to carolthecoach@aol.com, and I will really appreciate that. And for all my East Coast listeners, I hope you stay warm, and I hope that you're not all snowed in, but I suspect that you are. And next week, we've got Porn-Proof Kids, and though that is a blog for parents who are concerned that their kids have seen some porn. And how do you porn-proof kids, and how do you deal with it if the damage has already been done? So I'll see you back here next week. And as I say at the end of every show, you know there will only be one of you at all times. So I fearlessly want you to have the courage to be yourself. We'll see you next week.